At first glance, the Dons, the hilly neighborhood about 10 miles north of Dickens that Marpesa moved to after she married M.C. Panache, looks like any well-to-do African-American enclave. The tree-lined streets are twisting. The houses are fronted with immaculate Japanese-style gardens. The wind chimes somehow coerce the air currents into Stevie Wonder songs. American flags and campaign signs supporting crooked politicians are displayed proudly in the front yard. When we were dating, sometimes after a night out, me and Marpesa would cruise the neighborhood, wheeling Daddy's pickup truck through streets with Spanish names like Don Lugo, Don Marino, and Don Felipe. We used to refer to the modern but smallish homes with their pools, plate glass windows, stone facades, and weatherproofed balconies overlooking downtown Los Angeles as Brady Bunch houses. As in, the motherfucking Wilcoxes came up, dude. Them niggas kicking it in a Brady Bunch house off Don Quixote. We hoped one day to live in one of these homes and have a barrel of children. The worst thing that could happen to us was that we'd falsely accuse our oldest son of smoking. A poorly thrown football would break our daughter's nose, and our slightly slutty maid would constantly throw herself at the mailman. Then we'd die and go into worldwide syndication like all good American families. For 10 years, ever since our breakup, I'd periodically park outside her crib, wait until the lights went out, then through the binoculars and a sliver of open bay window curtain, I'd take in the life I should have been living. A life of sushi and Scrabble. Kids studying in the living room and playing with the dog. After the children went to bed, I'd watch Nosferatu and Metropolis with her, crying like a baby because the way Paulette Goddard and Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times circle around each other like two dogs in heat reminded me of us. Sometimes I'd sneak up to the porch and in the screen door, leave a snapshot of the growing satsuma tree on her porch with "Our son, Kazuo, says hello," written on the back. There isn't much you can do about segregating a school when school isn't in session. And that summer I spent more time outside her house than for legal reasons, I care to admit, until one warm August night, the 40-foot metro bus parked in Marpesa's driveway forced me to abort my stalker protocol. Like their white-collar comrades, it's not unusual for black, blue-collar employees like Marpesa to take their work home with them. Regardless of your income level, the old adage of having to be twice as good as the white man, half as good as the Chinese guy, and 4 times as good as the last Negro the supervisor hired before you still holds true. Nevertheless, I was surprised as hell to see the number 125 bus sitting in her driveway. Its back end blocking the sidewalk, its right side tires ruining a once perfect lawn. Tree photo in hand, I crept past the gardenias and the West Stack security sign. Rising to my tippy toes, I peered into a side window, cupping my hands around my eyes. Even in the cool of the midnight air, the vehicle was still warm and thick with the scent of gasoline and the sweat of the working class. It'd been 4 months since Hominy's birthday party, and the priority seating for seniors disabled and whites signs were still up. I wondered aloud how she got away with them. "She says it's an art project, nigga." The barrel of a snub-nosed 38 boring into my cheekbone was cold and impersonal, but the voice behind the gun was the exact opposite, warm and friendly, familiar. "Dude, if I hadn't recognized the smell of cow shit on your ass, you'd be dead as good black music." Stevie Dawson, Marpesa's younger brother, spun me around and, gun in hand, gave me a bear hug. Behind him stood a red-eyed cuz, a tipsy grin happily cutting across his mug. His boy Stevie was out of jail. I was glad to see him, too. It'd been at least 10 years. Stevie's rep was even more dastardly than cuz's. Gang unaffiliated only because he was too crazy for the Cripsets and too mean for the Bloods. Stevie hates nicknames because he feels real bad motherfuckers don't need one. And although there are a few hardheads around the way who answer to their Christian names, when niggas say Stevie, it's like a Chinese homophone. If you've been around, you know exactly who they mean. In California, you get three strikes. If you're convicted of two felonies, the next guilty verdict, no matter how minor, can mean life in prison. Somewhere along the line, the catcher must have dropped Stevie's third strike, because the system had sent him back to the plate. How'd you get out? Panache sprung it, Cuz answered, offering me a sip of Tanqueray that was almost as nasty as its diet grapefruit soda chaser. What? He performed one of his shitty benefit concerts and snuck you out in a speaker? Power of the pen. Between his TV cop gig and the beer commercials, Panache knows some big-time white people. Letters were written, and here I am, conditionally paroled like a motherfucker. What conditions? The condition that I don't get caught. What else? One of the dogs began to bark. The kitchen curtains parted, spilling light onto the driveway. I flinched, even though we were out of sight. No need to be scared. Panache ain't here. I know. He's never here. And how you know that? You been stalking my sister again?
Who's out there?
It was Marpesa, saving me from further embarrassment. I mouthed to Stevie that I wasn't there. It's just me and Cuz.
Well, bring your asses inside before something happens.
All right. We'll be in a second. The first time I met Stevie, back when he and his sister lived in Dickens, there was a limousine parked in front of their house. Except for prom night, you don't see many limos in the ghetto. And that black stretch Cadillac, crammed from minibar to back window with roughnecks, light and dark, tall and short, smart and stupid, held Stevie's boys. Boys who over the years disappeared in ones and twos, and on really bloody days, threes. Bank robberies, food truck holdups, assassinations. Panache and King Cuz were the only homies he had left. And though Stevie and Panache really liked each other, it was a relationship that profited both parties. Panache wasn't no punk, but Stevie gave him real street cred in the rap scene. And for Stevie, Panache's success reminded him that all things are possible if one can get the right white people on your side. Back then, Panache fancied himself a pimp. Sure, he had women doing shit for him, but what nigga didn't? I remember Panache in the living room staring Marpesa down, rapping what would become his first gold record, while Stevie DJ'd for him. 3 in the morning, Mormons at my pad, needing new croaker sacks and feeling bad, promising salvation to a nigga like me, Brigham Young must be stupid and high on PCP. If Stevie had a Latin motto, it'd be cogito ergo boogium. I think, therefore I jam.
How come Marpesa's bus is parked here? I asked him.
Nigga, how come you here? He barked back.
I wanted to leave this for your sister.
I showed him the photo of the Satsuma tree, which he snatched from my hand. I wanted to ask him if he'd received all the fruit I'd sent him over the years, the papayas, kiwis, apples, and blueberries. But I could tell from the suppleness of his skin, the whiteness of his eyes, the sheen in his ponytail and the relaxed way he leaned on my shoulder that he had.
She told me about you leaving these pictures.
Is she mad? Stevie shrugged and continued to stare at the Polaroid.
The bus here, because they lost Rosa Parks' bus.
Who lost Rosa Parks' bus?
White people. Who the fuck else?
Supposedly every February, when school kids visit the Rosa Parks Museum, or wherever the fuck the bus is at, the bus they tell the kids is the birthplace of the civil rights movement is a phony. Just some old Birmingham city bus they found in some junkyard. That's what my sister says, anyway.
I don't know.
Cuz took two deep swallows of gin.
What you mean, you don't know? You think that after Rosa Parks bitch-slapped white America, some white redneck's gonna go out their way to save the original bus? That'd be like the Celtics hanging Magic Johnson's jersey in the rafters of the Boston Garden. No fucking way.
Anyway, she thinks what you did with the bus, with the stickers and shit, is special. That it makes niggas think. In her way, she's proud of you.
Really?
I looked at the bus. Tried to see it in a different light. As something more than 40 sheet metal feet of trivial rites iconography dripping transmission fluid onto the driveway. Tried to picture it hanging from the ceiling of the Smithsonian, a tour guide pointing up to it and saying, "This is the very bus from which Hominy Jenkins, the last little rascal, asserted that the rights of African Americans were neither God-given nor constitutional, but immaterial." Stevie had the photo under his nose, took a deep breath, and asked, "When these oranges gonna be ready?" I wanted to point to the greenish-orange balls and brag about how I'd figured out that if I covered the ground around the tree with white waterproof sheeting, not only would I be able to keep moisture from seeping into the soil, the whiteness would reflect the sunlight back into the tree and improve the color of the fruit. But all I could manage was, "Soon. They'll be ripe soon." Stevie took one last sniff of the picture and then passed it under King Cuz's cavernous nostrils. "Smell that citrus, nigga? That's what freedom smells like." Then he grabbed me by the shoulders. "And what's this I hear about black Chinese restaurants?" Chapter 15. It was the smell that brung him. At about 6 in the morning, I found the first boy curled up in my driveway, breathing heavily, pressing his nose under the gate like a horny dog. He looked happy. He wasn't in the way, so I left him alone and went to milk the cows. Los Angeles, for whatever reason, is chock full of autistic children, and I thought he was one of the afflicted. But later in the day, he had company. By noontime, nearly every child on the block had crammed into my front yard. They spent the last day of summer vacation playing Uno on the grass and trying to see who could hit the softest. They plucked needles from the cacti and stuck each other in the behind. They popped my rose petals and scratched their names into the driveway with rock salt. Even the Lopez kids, Lori, Dory, Jerry, and Charlie, who lived next door and had 2 pristine acres of backyard and a decent-sized pool to play in, were circled around little brother Billy, laughing hysterically as he noshed on a peanut butter sandwich. Then a little girl I didn't recognize staggered over to the elm tree and drowned a column of ants in vomit. "Okay, what the fuck?" "The stank," Billy said, after swallowing a mouthful of a peanut butter and judging from what appeared to be bug legs on his tongue and flies sandwich. I didn't smell anything, so Billy dragged me out into the street. It wasn't hard to see why the young girl retched. The stench was overwhelming. The stank had rolled in overnight and settled over the neighborhood like some celestial flatulence. Jesus. But why hadn't I noticed it earlier? I stood in the middle of Bernard Avenue, the kids beckoning me over, waving frantically like World War I soldiers urging a wounded comrade out of the mustard gas and back into the relative safety of the trenches. As soon as I reached the curb, it hit me, the refreshing pungency of citrus. No wonder the kids refused to stray from my property. The satsuma tree was perfuming the grounds like some 10-foot-tall air freshener. Billy yanked my pant leg. "When those oranges gonna be ready?" I wanted to tell him tomorrow, but I was too busy pushing the little girl aside so I could throw up on the elm, gagging not from the smell, but because Billy had 2 red fly eyes stuck in his teeth. The next morning, the first day of school, the neighbor kids and their parents were gathered at the driveway gate. The youngsters, shiny and clean in brand-new school clothes, pawed at the wooden fence, trying to catch glimpses of the farm animals through the wooden slats. The adults, some still in their pajamas, yawned, looked at their watches, and adjusted their bathrobe belts as they placed milk money, 25 cents for a pint of my unpasteurized, in their children's hands. I sympathized with the parents, because after being up all night in the lingering remnants of the stank, building an imaginary all-white school, I was tired, too. It's hard to determine when satsumas are ripe. Color isn't a very good indicator. Neither is rind texture. Smell is good, but the best way to tell is simply to taste them. However, I trust the refractometer more than my taste buds.
"What's the reading, massa?"
16.8.
"Is that good?"
I tossed Hominy an orange. When satsumas are ready to eat, the skin is so supple they damn near peel themselves. He popped a wedge into his satchel mouth and pretended to faint dead away in a pratfall so well executed the rooster stopped crowing for fear the old man was dead.
Oh, shit!
The kids thought he was hurt. I did, too, until he flashed a wide,
"Yes, sir, boss. That's good eating."
Smile, as bright and warm as the rising sun. He stood up in sections, then soft-shoed and somersaulted his way to the fence, showing that there was some of both the old vaudevillian and the stunt coon still left in him.
"I sees white people,"
he exclaimed in faux horror. "Let 'em in, Hominy." Hominy opened the gate part way, as if he were peering through a chitlin' circuit curtain.
"A little black boy is in the kitchen, watching his mother fry up some chicken. Seeing the flour, he dabs some on his face. 'Look at me, ma,' he says. 'I'm white.' 'What'd you say?' says his mama. And the boy says, 'Look at me. I'm white.' Whap! His mama slaps the shit out of him. 'Don't you ever say that,' she says. Then tells him to go tell his father what he said to her. Crying hard as Niagara Falls, the boy goes up to his father. 'What's wrong, son?'
'Mommy slapped me.'
'Why she do that, son?' his father asked.
Because I said I was white.
What? Blam! His father slaps him even harder than his mama did. 'Now go tell your grandmother what you said. She'll teach you.' So the boy is crying and shaking and all confused. He approaches his grandmother. 'Why, baby, what's wrong?' she asks. And the boy says,
'They slapped me.'
'Why, baby? Why'd they do that?' He tells her his story. And when he gets to the end, pi-yow! His grandmama slaps him so hard she almost knocks him down. 'Don't you ever say that,' she says. 'Now what did you learn?' The boy starts rubbing his cheek and says, 'I learned that I've been white for only 10 minutes, and I hate you niggas already.'"
The kids couldn't tell whether he was joking or just ranting, but they laughed anyway, each finding something funny in his expressions, his inflections, the cognitive dissonance in hearing the word nigger coming from the mouth of a man as old as the slur itself. Most of them had never seen his work. They just knew he was a star. That's the beauty of minstrelsy. It's timelessness. The soothing foreverness in the languid bojangle of his limbs, the rhythm of his juba, the sublime profundity of his jive as he ushered the kids into the farm, retelling his joke in Spanish to an uncaptive audience running past him, cups and thermoses in hand, scattering the damn chickens.
"Un negrito está en la cocina mirando a su mamá freír un poco de pollo. Aprendí que he sido blanco por solo 10 minutos, y ya los odio a ustedes mayates."
They say breakfast is the most important meal of the day, and for some of those kids, it might be their only meal. So, in addition to the milk, I offered, children and adults alike, a fresh satsuma mandarin. I used to hand out candy canes and horsey rides on the first day of school, mount them 3 to a saddle, and pony the little shits to campus. Not anymore. Not when 2 years ago, the 6th grader Cipriano Candy Martinez, a half-Salvadorian, half-black boy who lived over on Prescott Place, tried to Lone Ranger and Hi-Yo Silver away his ass out of an abusive household. Following the steaming piles of horseshit, I had to go all the way to Panorama City to track him down. I picked up 2 kids straying near the stalls by their elbows and hoisted them into the air.
"Stay away from the fucking horses."
"What about the orange tree, mister?"
Unable to resist the enticing smell of the satsumas and hold off until recess or the soap operas for their midday snacks, my customers were huddled under the mandarin tree, guiltily standing in piles of peeled skin, their lips wet with fructose.
"Take as many as you want," I said.
My father used to say, "Give a nigger an inch and he'll take an L." I never knew what an L was, but in this case, it meant the stripping of my precious satsuma tree bear. Hominy, holding his lumpy stomach in both hands because he was 5 months pregnant with about 20 citrus fruit babies, ambled up to me.
"These greedy niggas gonna take all your oranges, massa."
"That's all right. I only need a couple." And to prove my point, a plump, blue-ribbon satsuma, trying its best to escape the feeding frenzy, rolled right up to my feet. An ebullient hominy, with sun on his face and the sweet taste of satsumas on his minstrel pink tongue, Pied Pipered the children to their dooms, followed by their doting, overprotective parents, and me, the biggest rat of them all, bringing up the rear. Christina Davis, a tall little girl whose lanky bones and white teeth owed their growth and strength to years of consumption of my unpasteurized milk, sidled up to me and clasped my hand with a solid grip. "Where's your mother?" I asked. Christina put her fingers to her lips and inhaled. In neighborhoods like Dickens, before concerned parents with Secret Service earpieces stuffed into their auditory canals marshaled your every move, you used to learn more on your way to and from school than you did in school. My father was aware of this, and to further my extracurricular education, every so often he'd drop me off in a strange neighborhood and make me walk to the local place of learning. It was a lesson in social orienteering, except that I didn't have a map, a compass, a mess kit, or a slang-to-slang dictionary. Thankfully, for the most part, in L.A. County, you can gauge the threat level of a community by the color of its street signs. In Los Angeles proper, the signs are a hollowed-out, metallic, midnight blue. If a bird's nest, constructed of pine needles, was tucked inside the sign, it meant evergreen trees and a nearby golf course. Mostly white public school kids, whose parents lived above their means in upper-middle-class neighborhoods like Cheviot Hills, Silver Lake, and the Palisades. Bullet holes and a stolen car wrapped around the post signified kids about my hair texture, allowance level, and clothing style in neighborhoods like Watts, Boyle Heights, and Highland Park. Sky blue signified kickback cool bedroom communities like Santa Monica, Rancho Palos Verdes, and Manhattan Beach. Chill dudes commuting to school by any means necessary, from skateboard to hang glider, the goodbye lipstick prints from their trophy wife mother still on their cheeks. Carson, Hawthorne, Culver City, Southgate, and Torrance are all designated by a working-class cactus green. There, the little homies are independent, familiar, and multilingual, fluent in Hispanic, Black, and Samoan gang signs. In Hermosa Beach, La Mirada, and Duarte, the street signs are the bland brown of cheap blended malt whiskey. The boys and girls mope their way to school, depressed and drowsy, past the hacienda-style tract housing. The sparkling white signs denote Beverly Hills, of course. Exceedingly wide, hilly streets lined with rich kids, unthreatened by my appearance. Assuming that if I was there, I belonged. Asking me about the tension of my tennis rackets. Schooling me on the blues, the history of hip-hop, Rastafarianism, the Coptic Church, jazz, gospel, and the myriad of ways in which a sweet potato can be prepared. I wanted to release Christina into the wild, urge her to take the most circuitous route to school possible, let her run unchaperoned under the jet-black street signs of Dickens, and take an honors class in snail trails. Audit a seminar in watching your friend walk into Bob's Big Boy and steal the breakfast tips from the counter. Formulate an independent study on the poetics of the rainbows and sprinkler water, and the call of the early bird purple-sequined halter-top prostitute caterwauling to potential Johns on Long Beach Boulevard. I was about to let Christina loose, but we'd reached the school just as the 9 o'clock bell rang. "Hurry up. You're going to be late."
"Everybody's already late," she said,
running off to join her friends. Everyone was late. Students, staff, faculty, parents, legal guardians, all were congregated in front of Chaff Middle School, ignoring the bell and taking the measure of their newly minted crosstown rivals from across the street. The Wheaton Academy Charter Magnet School of the Arts, Science, Humanities, Business, Fashion, and everything else was a sleek, state-of-the-art plate-glass building that looked more like a Death Star than a place of learning. Its student body was white and larger than life. None of this was real, of course, as the Wheaton Academy was a phony construction site. A vacant lot, now surrounded by a plywood fence painted blue, with small rectangle cutouts through which passerby could watch building that would never take place. The school was nothing more than a 5x5 watercolor artist's rendition of the Center of Marine Sciences at the University of Eastern Maine that I downloaded, had blown up, mounted under plastic, and attached to a gate bolted with a chain lock. The pupils were ballet dancers, platform divers, violinists, fencers, volleyball players, and pottery makers whose black and white photos I hijacked from the Intersection Academy and Haverford Meadowbrook websites had enlarged and pasted onto the fence. If anyone had been paying attention, they would have noticed that in reality the Wheaton Academy would be 10 times the size of the lot it was supposed to be built upon. But if the red letters stenciled underneath the drawing were to be believed, then by all indications the Wheaton Academy was indeed coming soon. Not soon enough for Dickens, of course, whose concerned but suspicious parents eager for their children to join the ranks of the giant Anglo kids, whose metal braces brightened not only their impossibly white smiles, but their futures. An overzealous mother, pointing demonstrably at a studious child and an attentive teacher poring over the results of a spectrograph pointed at the stars, asked Charisma the question on everyone's mind.
Assistant Principal Molina, what my kids have to do to go to that school? Take a test?
Of sorts.
What that mean?
What do those students in the photo all have in common?
They white.
Well, there's your answer. Your child can pass that test. They're in. But you didn't hear it from me.
All right, the show's over. Anybody who's ready to learn, let's go, because I'm locking the doors behind me. Vámonos, people!
By the time the 949 westbound arrived at Rosecrans in Long Beach, an obnoxious but punctual cloud of exhaust fumes, the crowd had long since dissipated, and I sat at the bus stop next to Hominy, smoking a doobie and cradling my last 2 Satsuma mandarins. Marpesa opened the bus doors, a sinister look somewhere between disregard and disgust stitched onto her face like an angry black woman Halloween mask. A look that might scare off her co-workers and the niggers on the corner, but not me. I tossed her the oranges, and she sped off without even a thank you. After 500 feet or so, the number 125 bus, its brakes invariably as worn out as a bum's shoes, slammed to an ear-splitting halt, reversed, and made a sharp right turn. The only real fights Marpesa and I ever had were about whether 3 rights made a left. She insisted they did. I believe that after 3 pointless right turns, you might be traveling left, but you'd be 1 block behind your original starting point. By the time the bus made its way back to me, having proved, if nothing else, that a couple of illegal U-turns puts you right back where you started from, the 949 was now the 957. The doors opened, Marpesa still at the wheel. This time her face was slathered with Satsuma juice and an irrepressible smile. I always liked the sound of seat belts unbuckling, that emancipating click and whir of the belt recoiling to wherever it goes never ceases to give me pleasure. Marpesa brushed away the peels in her lap and stepped off the bus.
"Okay, Bonbon, you win," she said,
plucking the joint from my mouth and marching her perfectly plump behind back onto the bus, apologizing for the delay, but not the smell as she buckled in and slipped into traffic, blowing smoke out of the narrow driver's side window, her pink fingernails coolly flicking ashes onto the street. She didn't know it, but she was smoking aphasia, so I knew that between us, bygones would be bygones, or as we say in Dickens, it be like that sometimes. Is existo amu ut interdum. Chapter 16. Later that day, like any good social pyromaniac worth their accelerant, I returned to the scene of the crime. The only arson investigator on site was Foy Cheshire. It was the first time in 20-some-odd years I'd ever seen him venture outside Dum Dum Donuts, his feet on actual Dickens' terra firma. And there he stood in front of the blue clapboards of the would-be Wheaton Academy, his Mercedes half-parked on the sidewalk, taking photographs with an expensive-looking camera. From atop my horse, on the chaff side of the street, I watched him snap a picture, then jot something down in his notebook. Above me, a student opened a second-story window, looked up from a school-issued microscope so old Leonhoek would have called it antiquated, and stuck her processed head into the air to gaze out at the Godzilla-sized child prodigy of the Wheaton Academy, peering into an electron microscope so advanced it'd make Caltech envious. From the other side of the street, Foy spotted me. He cupped his hands around his mouth and called out, the traffic speeding loudly up and down Rosecrans Avenue, forcing me to play peekaboo with both his image and his words. "You see this shit, sellout? You know who did this?" "Yeah, I know." "Damn right, you know. Only the forces of evil would stick an all-white school in the middle of the ghetto."
"Like who? The North Koreans or somebody?"
"What the North Koreans care about, Foy Cheshire. This is without a doubt a CIA conspiracy, or maybe even bigger, like a secret HBO documentary about me. Some nefarious shit is afoot. Which if you've been to a meeting in the past couple of months, did you know some racist asshole put a sign on a public bus?" It used to be that when some fools did a drive-by, an oncoming car slowing down for no apparent reason was fair warning. The throaty belch of a V6 engine losing RPM and slipping into first gear was the urban equivalent of the crack of a hunter snapping a twig and startling his prey. But with these new hybrid, silent-running, energy-saving automobiles, you don't hear shit. By the time you realize what's going on, a bullet has slammed into the back quarter panel of your iridium silver Benz, and your assailants have already quietly sped off, yelling, "Take your black ass back to white America, nigga!" while getting 55 miles to the gallon. I thought I recognized the laugh that belonged to the thin black arm holding the familiar-looking revolver that looked a lot like the gun Marpesa's brother Stevie had held to my head 2 weeks prior. And the stealth gangsterism of an electric car drive-by had all the earmarks of King Cuz's battlefield generalship. As I made my way across the street to see if Foy was okay, I definitely recognized the scent of the orange that one of the assailants had thrown upside Foy's head. That was one of my satsumas.
"Foy, you okay?"
"Don't touch me. This is war, and I know whose side you're on." I backed away as Foy dusted himself off, muttering about conspiracies and defiantly marching toward his car like he was leaving the Philippines under siege. The gull-wing door to his classic sports car opened up, and before getting in, Foy paused to put on his aviator sunglasses and, in his best general Black Arthur, announced, "I shall return, motherfucker. Believe that shit." Behind us, the student on the second floor closed her window and returned to her microscope, blinking rapidly as she readjusted the focus, moved the slide around, and scribbled her findings in her notebook. Unlike Foy and me, she was resigned to her situation, because she knows that in Dickens it be like that sometimes, even when it doesn't have to be. Apples and Oranges. Chapter 17. I'm frigid. Not in the sense that I don't have any sexual desire, but in the obnoxious way men in the free-love 70s projected their own sexual inadequacies onto women by referring to them as frigid and dead fish. I'm the deadest of fish. I fuck like an overturned guppy. A plate of day-old sashimi has more motion of the ocean than I do. So on the day of the shooting and drive-by oranging, when Marpesa stuck a tongue suspiciously tangy with Satsuma tartness into my mouth and ground her pudenda into my pelvic bone, I lay there on the bed, motionless.
my hands covering my face in shame, because fucking me is like fucking Tutankhamun's sarcophagus. If my sexual ineptitude was a problem, she never let on. She simply boxed my ears and worked my beached whale carcass over like a Saturday night wrestler looking for revenge in a grudge match I didn't want to end. Does this mean we're back together? It means I'm thinking about it. Can you think about it a little faster and maybe a little more to the right? Yeah, that's it. Marpesa's the only person to ever diagnose me. Not even my father could figure me out. I'd make a mistake, like, say, misidentify Mary McLaude Bethune for Gwendolyn Brooks. It'd be, nigger, I have no fucking idea what the fuck is wrong with you. Followed by all 943 pages of the BDSM-4, Black Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 4th edition, flying at my head. Marpesa sorted me out, though. I was 18, 2 weeks from finishing up my first semester of college. We were in the guest house, she thumbing through the blood-stained BDSM-4, me in my usual post-coital position, rolled up into a ball like a frightened teenage armadillo and crying my eyes out for no earthly reason. "Here, I finally figured out what's wrong with you," she said, snuggling up to me. "This is what you have, attachment disorder." Why do people have to tap the page when they know they're right? A quick read aloud will suffice. You don't have to rub it in with all the smug finger-tapping. Attachment disorder. Markedly disturbed and developmentally inappropriate social relatedness in most contexts, scenes, and happenings, beginning before age 5 and continuing into adulthood as evidenced by either 1 and or 2. 1. Persistent failure to initiate or respond in a developmentally appropriate fashion to most social interactions. For example, the child or adult responds to caregivers and black lovers with a mixture of approach, avoidance, and resistance to comforting. May exhibit frozen watchfulness. Hoi polloi translation. The nigger flinches or jumps whenever you touch him, runs hot and cold, and has no friends to speak of. And when he isn't staring at you like you just got off the banana boat, he's crying like a little bitch. 2. Diffuse attachments as manifested by indiscriminate sociability with marked inability to exhibit appropriate selective attachments to black people and things. For example, excessive familiarity with relative strangers or lack of selectivity in choice of attachment figures. Hoi polloi translation. The nigger fucking white hoes out there at UC Riverside. It was a miracle we lasted as long as we did. I stared at her blurry silhouette for a long time before she poked her head from behind the chessboard pattern shower curtain. I'd forgotten how brown she was, how good she looked, her stringy hair clumped to the side of her face. Sometimes the sweetest kisses are the shortest. We could discuss the clean-shaven pubes later. Bonbon, what's the time frame? For us? From now until. For the segregation thing, I'm thinking I want to be done by Hood Day. That gives me another 6 months. Marpesa pulled me in and handed me a tube of apricot scrub that hadn't been opened since the last time she showered off there. I rubbed the exfoliant into her back and scratched a message into the grainy, supposedly skin-softening swirls. She always could read my writing. Because, between that nigga Foy and the rest of the world, this shit's gonna catch up with you sooner or later. Forget the racial segregation. You know motherfuckers wasn't too keen on Dickens even when it did exist. You were in that car today, weren't you? Shit. When Cuz and my brother picked me up from work and we drove back here, soon as we crossed that white line you painted, it was like, you know, when you enter a banging-ass house party and shit's bumping, and you get that thump in your chest, and you be like, if I were to die right now, I wouldn't give a fuck. It was like that, crossing the threshold. You threw that fucking orange. I knew it. Hit that stupid motherfucker square in the face. Marpesa pressed the crack of her shapely rear end into my groin.
She had to get back to the kids. We wouldn't have much time, and knowing me, we wouldn't need much time. Despite that initial scratch of her 17-year itch, Marpesa insisted we start slow. Since she worked weekends and put in crazy overtime, we had to date on Mondays and Tuesdays. Our nights on the town were trips to the mall, coffee shop poetry readings, and most bothersome for me, open mic nights at the Plethora Comedy Club. Marpesa hated my Wheaton Chaff segregation joke and insisted that I improve my sense of humor by learning to tell a joke. When I protested, she'd say, "Look, now you ain't the only black man in the world that can't fuck, but I refuse to go out with the only one with absolutely no sense of humor." From the music clubs to the jailhouses to the fact that you can find Korean taco trucks only in white neighborhoods, L.A. is a mind-numbingly racially segregated city. But the epicenter of social apartheid is the stand-up comedy scene. The city of Dickens's paltry contribution to the long-running tradition of black funny men is an open mic night sponsored by the Dum Dum Donut Intellectuals that on the second Tuesday of the month transforms the shop into a 20-table club called the Comedy Act and Forum for the Freedom of Afro-American Witticism and Mannerisms that showcase the plethora of Afro-American humorists for whom... There's more, but I've never managed to finish reading the temporary marquee they hang over the giant donut sign that hovers over the parking lot. I just call the place the Plethora, for short, because despite Marpesa's insistence that I had no sense of humor, there was a plethora of unfunny black guys who, like every black sports analyst trying to sound intelligent, use and misuse the word plethora at every opportunity. As in, question, how many white boys does it take to screw in a light bulb? Answer, a plethora, because they stole it from a black man. Lewis Latimer, a black man who invented the light bulb and a plethora of other smart-ass shit. And believe me, jokes like that would get a plethora of applause. Every black male, I don't care what shade or political persuasion he is, secretly thinks he can do one of three things better than anyone in the world. Play basketball, rap, or tell jokes. If Marpesa thinks that I'm not funny, she never heard my father. Back in the heyday of black stand-up comedy, he also dragged me to the Tuesday night open mics. In the history of American black people, there have been only two with the complete inability to tell a joke. Martin Luther King, Jr., and my father. Even at the Plethora, the comedians would occasionally lapse into unintentional humor. I'm auditioning for a role in Tom Cruise's newest movie. Tom Cruise plays a retarded judge. The problem with open mic night at the Plethora was that there was no time limit, because time is a white concept, which was fitting, because the problem with my father's comedy was that he had no sense of timing. At least Dr. King had the good sense to never try to tell a joke. Daddy told his jokes the same way he'd ordered pizza, written poetry, and written his doctoral thesis, in APA format. Following the standards of the American Psychological Association, he'd toddle on stage and open up with the oral equivalent of a title page. Stating his name and the title of the joke, yes, his jokes had titles. This joke is called Racial and Religious Differences in Drinking Establishment Patronage. Then he'd deliver the abstract of the joke. So instead of simply saying, a rabbi, a priest, and a black guy walk into a bar, he'd say, the subjects of this joke are three males, two of whom are clergymen, one of the Jewish faith, the other an ordained Catholic minister. The religion of the African-American respondent is undetermined, as is his educational level. The setting for the joke is a licensed establishment where alcohol is served. No, wait, it's a plane. I'm sorry, my mistake. They're going parachuting. Finally, he'd clear his throat, stand too close to the mic, and deliver what he liked to call the main body of the joke. Comedy is war. When a comedian's routine works, they've killed. If the bits fall flat, they refer to it as dying.
My father didn't die on stage. He martyred himself for that other unrecognized, completely unfunny black man who, just as there must be extraterrestrial life, is out there somewhere. I've seen self-immolations that were funnier than my father's routine, but there were no gongs to ring or oversized canes with which to pull him off stage. He'd just ignore the booing and segue from the punchline to the conclusion. The results of the joke were a smattering of coughing. A chorus of vocalized disapproval and a plethora of yawning found to be significant. He'd end with the joke's reference section. Jolson, Al, 1918. Sambo and Mammy cleared for takeoff on Runway 5. Ziegfeld Follies. Williams, Bert, 1917. If Niggas Could Fly, the Circuitous Chitlin Tour. The Unknown Minstrel, circa 1899. Dim Vaudeville Peckerwood, show am stealing my shit. The Semi-Freemason Hall, Cleveland, Ohio. And don't forget to tip your waitress. Even though she'd be exhausted from a long day transporting the masses, Marpesa would make sure we arrived early, volunteering me for comic duty by putting my name at the top of the sign-up sheet. I can't tell you how much I dreaded hearing the MC introduce me. Now, put your hands together for Bon Bon. I would stand on that stage feeling as if I were having an out-of-body experience, staring out into the audience and seeing myself in the front row, prepping rotten tomatoes, eggs, and spoiled lettuce heads to throw at the droll motherfucker telling every ripped-off, antiquated Richard Pryor joke he could remember from his father's record collection. But every Tuesday night, Marpesa forced me to take the stage, saying that she would continue withholding sex until I made her laugh. Usually, after my so-called routine, I'd return to the table to find her fast asleep, unable to tell if she was exhausted from work or from boredom. One night, I finally managed to tell an original joke that, in homage to my father, had a title, albeit a rather long one. Why all that Abbott and Costello vaudeville mess doesn't work in the black community? Who's on first? I don't know. Your mama? Marpesa cracked the fuck up, rolling in the thin space between the folding chairs that passed for an aisle. I knew the sex trial would end that night. They say never laugh at your own jokes, but all the best comics do. And as soon as the open mic was closed, I sprinted outside and hopped aboard bus number 125, which was parked right outside the club, because Marpesa was using it as the family car, afraid to let the rolling memorial out of her sight. Before she could even think about releasing the parking brake, I was already lying naked on the back seat, ready for a tinted window quickie. Marpesa reached under the driver's seat, pulled out a large cardboard box, dragged it down the aisle, and dumped the contents in my lap, burying my aching erection in 2 inches of report cards, computer printouts, and progress reports. "What the fuck's all this?" I asked, sifting through the paperwork so my dick could get some air. I'm acting as charisma's go-between. It's early yet, it's only been 6 weeks, but she thinks the segregated schooling is already working. Grades are up and behavioral problems are down, but she wants you to confirm those results with some statistical analysis. God damn it, Marpesa! It's gonna take just as long to put all this shit back in the box as it will to do the math. Marpesa grabbed the base of my penis and squeezed. Bon Bon, are you ashamed of my being a bus driver? What? Where's this coming from? Nowhere. No amount of my amateur ear nuzzling was able to erase the wistful look on her face or make her nipples erect. Bored at my attempts at foreplay, she slipped a progress report into my pee hole and twisted my dickhead around so that I could read it like it was the early bird dinner menu. A sixth grader named Michael Gallegos was taking subjects I didn't understand and getting grades I couldn't decipher. But according to the teacher's comments, he was showing marked improvement in something called number sense and operations. What the hell kind of grade is a PR?
PR means shows proficiency.
Charisma had intuitively grasped the psychological subtleties of my plan, even as it was just starting to make sense to me. She understood the colored person's desire for the domineering white presence, which the Wheaton Academy represented, because she knew that even in these times of racial equality, when someone whiter than us, richer than us, blacker than us, Chineser than us, better than us, whatever than us, comes around throwing their equality in our faces, it brings out our need to impress, to behave, to tuck in our shirts, do our homework, show up on time, make our free throws, teach, and prove our self-worth in hopes that we won't be fired, arrested, or trucked away and shot. In essence, Wheaton Academy is saying to her students what Booker T. Washington, the great educator and founder of the Tuskegee Institute, once told his uneducated people. Cast down your buckets where you are.
While I've never understood why it had to be a bucket, while the short-sighted Booker T. couldn't recommend that we cast down our books, slide rules, or laptops, I did sympathize with his and Charisma's need for an on-call Caucasian panopticon. Believe me, it's no coincidence that Jesus, the commissioners of the NBA and NFL, and the voices on your GPS, even the Japanese one, are white.
There are no greater anaphrodisiacs than racism and a report card in one's urethra. And when a half-naked Marpesa clambered on top of me, both she and my penis laid their sleepy heads down in the vicinity of my belly button, she still clutching my phallus, having gone to wherever it is bus drivers go to dream. Flight school, probably, because in Marpesa's dreams, buses can fly. They arrive on time and never break down. They use rainbows for bridges and clouds for docking bays, and wheelchair riders roll and yaw alongside like fighters protecting a bomber wing. When she reaches cruising altitude, she clears flocks of seagulls and niggers migrating south for the rest of their lives with a horn that doesn't beep, but plays Roxy Music, Bon Iver, Sonny Levine, and Nico's These Days. And all her passengers make a living wage. And Booker T. Washington is a regular rider who, when he boards the bus, tells her, "When you see Bon Bon, the cosmic sellout, and your one true love, cast down your panties where you are."
Chapter 18. Come November, about 6 weeks after the shooting, I was making good progress with Marpesa, but less headway on what were, since I was now having sex on a semi-regular basis, the two more immediate goals in my life, segregating Dickens and raising a successful potato crop in Southern California. I knew why I couldn't get the potatoes to grow, because the climate's too warm. But when it came to thinking of good ideas for separating the races by race, all of a sudden I had racism block, and Hood Day was only a few months away. Maybe I was like every other contemporary artist. I had only one good book, one album, one despicable act of large-scale self-hatred in me. Hominy and I were in the row I dedicated to the tubers. Me on my hands and knees, checking the compost mixture, the soil density, and shoving russet seed potatoes in the ground, while he brainstormed suggestions for citywide discrimination and fucked up the one job he had, which was to lay the garden hose with the holes I punctured into it face up.
"Massa, what if we gave everybody we don't like a badge and assigned them to camps?"
"That's been done."
"Okay. How about this? Designate people into three groups. Black, colored, and godlike. Institute some curfew laws and a pass system."
"Old hat, coffer boy."
"This'll work in Dickens, because everybody, Mexican, Samoan, or black, is basically a shade of brown."
He dropped the hose on the wrong side of the trench and dug into his pocket.
"Now, at the bottom, we'll have the untouchables. These are the people who are completely useless. Clippers fans, traffic cops, and people who have dirty jobs where they work with human and animal waste, like yourself."
"So, if I'm an untouchable, and you're my slave, what does that make you?"
As a talented artist and thespian, I's a Brahmin. After I die, I get nirvana. You come back exactly to where you are now, wallowing in cow shit.
I appreciated the help, but as Hominy rattled on about the Vamas and delineating his version of the Indian caste system, as it might apply to Dickens, I began to figure out what my mental block was. I was feeling guilty. Realizing I was the Arschloch at the Wannsee Conference, the Afrikaner parliamentarian in Johannesburg in 48, the wannabe hipster on the Grammy committee who, in an effort to make the award more inclusive, comes up with meaningless categories like Best R&B Performance by Duo or Group with Vocals and Best Rock Instrumental by a soloist who knows how to program but can't play any instruments. I was the fool who, as topics like railroad car allotments, Bantu stands, and alternative music were raised, was too cowardly to stand up and say, "Do you motherfuckers realize how ridiculous we sound right now?" With the potatoes planted, the compost spread, and the hose finally in the correct furrow, it was time to test my makeshift irrigation system. I opened the water spigot and watched 100 feet of unpunctured green garden hose swell as it wound its way through the string beans, past the Spanish onions, and around the cabbage, until 6 jets of water squirted into the sky, arcing high over but not onto the potatoes, turning a small barren patch of land near the back fence into a mini floodplain. Either the holes were too small, or the water pressure was too high. In any case, there'd be no homegrown spuds this year. Next week's forecast was for 80 degrees, way too warm to get any kind of root vegetables started.
"Massa, you not gonna turn it off? You wasting water."
"I know."
"Well, then maybe next time you plant the potatoes in the dirt where the water's landing."
"I can't. That's where my dad's buried." Motherfuckers don't believe I buried him in the backyard, but I did. Had my lawyer, Hampton Fisk, backdate some forms and planted him in the far corner where the stagnant pond used to be. Nothing ever grows over that square of land. Not before he died or since. There's no headstone. Before Marpesa's Satsuma tree, I tried to plant an apple tree for a cenotaph. Dad used to like apples. He ate them all the time. People who didn't know him thought he was really healthy, because you'd rarely see him in public without a Macintosh and a can of V8. Pops loved the Braeburns and the Galas, but the Honeycrisps were his favorites. Offer him a bland-ass Red Delicious, and he'd look at you like you were talking bad about his mama. I regret that I never checked the pocket of his sports coat when he died. I'm certain there was an apple in there. He always brought one to nibble on after the meetings were over. If I had to guess, I'd say it was a golden russet. Those keep well during winter. We never grew apple trees, though. Much as he complained about the pretentious white people on the west side, I think he secretly liked to drive over to Gelson's whenever they had opalescence on sale for $4.50 a pound. Or to the farmer's market, if some enterprises were in. I drove all the way to Santa Paula looking for a tree to plant. Something special. Since the late 1890s, Cornell University has been breeding the world's best apples. The school used to be chill. If you asked nicely and paid the shipping and handling, they'd send you a box of late-season Jonagold just to spread the gospel. But in recent years, for whatever reason, Cornell has taken to licensing the new varietals to local farmers. And unless you own a farm in upstate New York, you're shit out of luck and have to make do with the occasional imported Florina. So now the university orchards in Geneva, New York, are to the black market apple trade what Medellin, Colombia is to cocaine. My connect was Oscar Zocalo, my lab partner at Riverside, who was doing his postgrad at Cornell. We met in the airport parking lot during an air show. Yahoos flying big planes, putting Sopwith camels and Curtises through their paces. Oscar insisted we do the deal car window to car window, crime movie style. The sample was so delicious that I scooped up the excess juice running down my chin
and rubbed it into my gums. I don't know if this is irony or not, but the best fucking apples taste like peaches. I drove home with a ready-for-ground velvet scrumptious tree, the crack of the apple world, insane yield, perfect